We are quickly approaching the end of 2024. And if you have not purchased an investment property yet this year, and it's been one of your goals, I need you to listen very closely. I know many of you live in areas where it's so expensive and investment properties seem impossible. I'm talking about some of the big cities. So LA, New York City, maybe even Seattle, Atlanta, places in Florida, and the list goes on. If you know that where you live is too expensive, I need you to lock in right now. Investing out of state changed my life as somebody living in California. I now invest in Ohio and I'm growing my portfolio. It's something that's possible. You just need the right information and execution. So if that's you, if you want to learn how to invest out of state, go to outofstatemoney.com and there is a free training that'll outline the steps for you and help you understand exactly what it takes. So go to outofstatemoney.com or simply go to the link in the description of this episode.
Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second? Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue. And the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, episode 235. Before we get into this episode, please be sure to leave a rating and review wherever you listen to this show. Definitely appreciate it, and I always enjoy hearing your feedback. I'm so excited about this episode. This one was recorded in DC. I had an opportunity to go out there not too long ago and participate in a conference and get a couple interviews done. As you all know, my goal is to give you as much information as possible and specific and practical information that you can implement when it's your time to go ahead and invest in real estate. And this interview with Taylor Salmon definitely did that. So I'm not gonna hold you up. Without further ado, let's get into it. All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue. If you're on YouTube, make sure you like this video and subscribe to the channel. If you're on the audio side, make sure you leave us a rating and review. We are live in DC. I'm very excited for this episode. Here with me, I have Taylor Salmon. Taylor, thank you so much. Appreciate you coming on the show. It's been a long time coming.
It has. Thank you for having me. I appreciate you coming all the way to DC from LA. So thank you.
Absolutely. I love it here. You know, definitely looking forward to coming back, and hopefully I'll come back sooner. Great people and great food, everything. So shout out to the DMV.
Go us. Go us.
Love it, love it. So you currently have 10 plus units valued at $6 million or so dollars, and you're also been a very successful realtor. So congrats to you on that and all your accomplishments. Just want to give you a shout out before we get started.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And congrats on your success as well.
Thank you. Thank you.
But yeah, I've been in the game for almost 10 years, learned a lot, but wouldn't be here without mentorship and people helping me and asking questions. So, but yeah, 2015, I got my realtor's license and I read Rich Dad Poor Dad. Did you read that too?
I did.
Feel like everybody reads that. Yeah. And that kind of was the catalyst in me learning about real estate and wealth building. Oh, and wealth building. So, read the book, ended up joining a real estate brokerage and team. And with the team, I learned a lot. Ended up buying my first house about 2 years later and bought it and did some work to it, got some equity. And from there, used the equity in my first home to purchase my then follow-on properties, whether they were flips or BRRRR, which is like the buy, rehab, rent, refinance, repeat. So yeah, it started with the book, the team, learning, and renovating my first house. And I learned a lot. So yeah, it's been great.
Sounds like it's been a great journey. And there's one thing you mentioned during our first conversation that stuck with me. You said you bought the ugly house. I don't know if you remember that, but you said you bought the ugly house. And as someone just getting started in real estate, the majority of the time, people are not looking to do that. So why did you buy the ugly house?
Because it's you see the vision. It's like, I like Kendrick Lamar before he was Kendrick Lamar, because you just knew the value in what they were going to become. So it's same with the ugly house. If I know there's an ugly house on 123 Main Street and 127 Main Street sold, you know, for 30, 40, 50% higher, I see the vision there. So it might take a little work, but there's value in it because there's equity in it. When it's kind of like stocks, when everybody finds out it's a great deal, it's too late. So you want to get in before everyone knows. And you do that by properly assessing a neighborhood, properly assessing the house as is, and also having like a good realtor and being super educated on the market and what's developing in that area too.
What gave you the courage to see that vision? Like, you know what, this is my first property, my first time I'm doing this, but you know, I'm gonna do the work with a team, do the renovations and all those things. What gave you the courage to do that? Because that's pretty uncommon, because most times when people are looking to invest in real estate, a lot of times just there's a lot of apprehension, there's a lot of nerves, and you don't want to mess up. But what was it within you that gave you that courage?
That's a good question. We talked about, my family is from Jamaica, my dad, so I was kind of raised around that mindset of you figure it out, but you do what you have to do to succeed. And in somewhere along that line, there is a cushion of maybe like a, I don't want to call it delusion, but like you really believe you can do something. And sometimes that level of being naive or not knowing how bad something can get is sometimes the push that we need to really move forward. Now, don't get me wrong, your decisions should be educated and, you know, do your homework and also have someone by your side to kind of walk you through your decisions. But you've got to have a little bit of just, I'm going to figure out, like, I'm going to get this done. I know I can because I know someone that has done it, and I know the steps and precautions I need to do to get there, if that makes sense.
It does.
It might be innate, mm-hmm. You know, kind of like, yeah.
That makes sense. Did you use a certain program to fund the rehab, or did you have to pay for the rehab out of pocket?
No, it was my first house. So I did what's called a home style renovation loan. So I could have done a 203K loan, which is the FHA product. But my lender, I was pretty close to my lender because we had known each other for a while. And he was like, you could do 203K, but you could also do home star renovation. You can just, if you can put down a little bit more and you have a good credit, go this route because your monthly payment will be less and your interest rate will be less. So that was a program I used. It was a renovation product similar to a 203K, but he really advised me, and that's why I always go back to having mentorship and people to really guide you along the way. So if he didn't advise that, I wouldn't have done it. I probably would have done a 203K and had a little bit higher of an interest rate, but yeah, that's the product I used.
Appreciate that. I don't know. I mean, maybe you had one other person talk about the home style renovation, but since you have experience, of course, using that plus advising clients on various things, what would you say are the main differences? Like maybe a few main differences between FHA 203K, which a lot of people talk about, and home style renovation, which not many people seem to talk about, but seems like a viable product.
Yeah, they're both similar outside of the qualifications to get there. The biggest thing is that home style, you're going to have a little bit more luxurious renovations. Like you can put a swimming pool in your home and the bank will finance it, which is nice. Who wouldn't want a pool? You can also do like a barbecue pit. But with FHA, you have to do renovations that are a little bit more practical. Obviously they can be nice, but some lenders are not going to say a barbecue pit or a swimming pool is necessary to bring a house to a certain value or livability. But also your credit score has to be 680 for home style, and then your credit score can be as low as 580 for the 203K, which is nice. You can also put 3.5% down for the 203K, which is nice. But with the home style, your down payment is 5% because it's conventional. So I think 203K is great for a first-time buyer. Like, it's a no-brainer to me. And you have to have a renovation consultant with both types of loans, so it's like someone holding your hand. But FHA is going to be a little bit more scrutinized in terms of, like, every step of the way, which is great for first-time home buyers, which is why I would not stray from a 203K.
That makes a lot of sense, because I'm sure one of the questions people are asking as we're talking so far is, okay, wow, she was able to do a renovation through this particular program for her first property. Wow, what did she do as far as the renovation? But now you mentioned that there is somebody in between to support with whoever's doing the work. So what was that experience like for you getting that renovation done? What are some lessons you learned, challenges? I would just love to hear about that experience.
Man, it was so many lessons. It's like your first fall off a bike your first time, you learn a lot. But I didn't fall off my bike. So, you know, obviously the lender, and I want to add too, like there was a guy named John Settles. He was a part of my finance team, and he wasn't directly working with me, but he was another, a black man who saw another black person, really wanted to help. And he was guiding me through the whole process. He showed me a good, you know, electrician, a good plumber, a lot of masonry folks. So anyway, they were like, you'll need to get 3 quotes. So I went on Angie's List, like just like crazy stuff like that. Went on Angie's List, found 3 people, got a really high quote from a developer over in Capitol Hill. I was like, nah. Then I got a middle quote. I don't think they could do everything I wanted. And of course, being my first time, I went with the lowest quote. Was not a good decision in going with the lowest. That was probably my first mistake. But when you get these bids from the contractors, they have to give those bids to the bank. And the bank's got to sign off and say, okay, your flooring will cost $10,000, your roofing will cost $15,000, plumbing another $20,000. So the bank is like eyeing it, and they're checking each contractor's either ratings in the, you know, Business Better Bureau or just their returns. So the bank is really like, they care about you as a buyer, but they're like, we don't want to mess up our equity partners, so we're going to make sure this guy is good. And he was. He just happened to be the lowest bid. And I think when you get multiple bids, it should be like a number that they all kind of, you know, come in around. And you want to keep an eye on that. And this guy was just a lot lower. But again, I'm like, I don't want to go too high because then I'm going to be outside of my budget. So I went with him. It worked out for a little bit, and then I had to fire him. So I learned a lot about draw schedules. I don't know if you know, you're aware of, you know, like it was 5 draws. He kept asking for money too soon before the work was done, and the bank kept telling him no, and then he would stop working, and it was so bad that I think he failed an inspection, and he wouldn't go back and do the work because he hadn't gotten paid, but the bank wasn't going to pay him. So we had $40,000 left in the work. It was like, we were like almost done. He was like, I can't move forward because I need to get paid. But the bank is like, you're supposed to do X, Y, and Z. So had to fire him, and they allowed me to use that extra money to hire someone else, which I did. So it can be complicated for sure. But you don't know these things until you know, you know? That was a long answer, my bad.
No, that's what we're here for. Okay. I want people to hear the full explanation and really understand what your experience has been. And for those who may not be familiar with just like working with contractors and things of that nature, can you explain what a draw schedule is?
Sure. So if you have a renovation loan, let's say it's $50,000 and you want to do some work, the bank doesn't give you $50,000 up front. They give you $50,000 over progress payments. They used to give like 30% up front for materials. I'm not sure if they do that anymore, but they'll say, all right, you finished your permitting, you finished demolition, you got your framing up, we'll give you, you know, 20% of the $50,000, whatever your budget schedule is. So you get those payments in draws. It's just not one lump sum up front because, you know, as time goes on, you'll figure out that a lot of contractors aren't good with managing money. And a lot of times they have a lot of projects going on. So that is why the bank gives the reimbursements in schedules and in draw reimbursements.
Got it. And so the cost of the renovation, is it rolled into the loan?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So typically, let's say if you buy a $100,000 house and your renovation is $50,000, they will roll that into an entire loan of $150,000 total. And you might have to pay about, 3% or 3.5%, whatever your down payment is, you'll pay 3.5% of that purchase and rehab cost. And then what happens is, also keep in mind that your renovation loan, your 203K loan, your Homestar renovation loan, these are at higher interest rates because they're more riskier to the bank. However, once you're done with your renovation, the bank then allows you to refinance into a market rate interest rate. So you can have a lower interest rate, and then you refinance into a 30-year or a 15-ARM, whatever your long-term financing is going to be.
So it sounds like these are two great options, the Homestyle and the 203K for folks who, you know, want to force some appreciation, build up some equity at the outset. And it's great because you still get experience like with the renovations, and even, you know, if things don't always go as planned, it's almost like you have a safety net, so to speak, because the bank is looking out for their interests. And, you know, they, I think you said there's a consultant on the 203K side. Is there something similar in Homestyle too?
Mm-hmm.
So consultant. You have that person in between. To me, it seems like a great introduction to real estate where there's some guardrails in place. And a lot of people are afraid of, you know, doing renovations and things of that nature. However, it could be very beneficial, and these could be some good options. And also, obviously, the lower down payment, if you need that as well, I think is also good.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's important. I think if, like you said, the bank, I see this from such a business mindset. The bank is not going to loan you money if they don't see value in whatever you're doing. They're just not. They have FHA, Fannie, Freddie. They're backed by the government, so they really have tight guidelines that they have to follow, so they're not going to mess up. I think when it becomes risky is the renovation portion with contractors. And to kind of contradict this fear or this uncertainty, what I always tell buyers now who are going through this is find someone who has worked with these contractors before. Now, you know, we could say, all right, well, why don't you do that? And I was like, well, I did. So what I did was I found these three companies and asked for their referrals. I could give you three of my greatest referrals, but I'm not going to give you the worst ones, right? So there is ways to really do your due diligence. But what I would do now is I ask for referral, I ask for contractors from people that I know, like you and that I can text. Mm-hmm. So like the guy I had mentioned, John Settles, who was a part of the lending team on my first house, he has been an imperative part of my journey because he gave me people. Like, he is someone that, like, I knew his wife, his kids. He's giving me my electrician. He's giving me my plumber, giving me my HVAC technician, my masonry guy. All of my trades I got from him. And even though I didn't use him on that first house because I had to use one GC, on my next six, five, whatever houses, I used all those people, but they came directly from him. So I think the lesson I learned in that was find someone that you know at arm's length versus just asking for referrals, you know, straight from the contractor. You should still do that. But sometimes I think when you have a close relationship with someone, they're not going to let you fail. And if they had a personal bad experience, they're not going to let you go through the same thing. I just think there's just levels to referrals, just like in any business. But yeah.
For those who may not know, what is a GC and what is masonry?
Sorry. GC is your general contractor. So this is essentially the manager or the general overseer of all of the tradesmen. What are tradesmen? Your tradesmen or women are people like your electricians who install new electricity throughout a home, your plumber who installs new plumbing, your HVAC who will take care of your heating and central air or whatever type of system you have. Your masonry is my guys, essentially someone who does our framing, our brickwork, our drywall, plaster. You could have a painter. So these are all just different tradesmen. Your masonry guy, I call him masonry because he does everything. like framing and brickwork, but yeah. They're not all called that, but yes.
Yeah, right. So you bought that first property. You went through all these experiences. That was a multifamily, I'm assuming. Was that a single family?
The first one?
Yeah.
Single family.
Got you. Okay.
Over here on H Street.
So you're right in the neighborhood. You told me that earlier. Yeah, yeah. So
I love A Street.
Yeah, absolutely. It's dope. Just like walking around and seeing what's over here. It's a cool area.
It is. People hate on it, but I love it.
Hate on it? Why?
I'm
not from here, so I don't know.
Because it's just so many restaurants, which is a good thing, right? Uh-huh. I loved it here because I could wake up, crust in my eye, and I could walk 30 seconds to get coffee, like 5 minutes, and be just. Everything is at your fingertips. Mm-hmm. Trolley, veterinarian for the dog. Like, it's everything is, and I appreciate that. To me, that says you don't need a car, and that's a less of an expense you need. So I find value in that. But you know, like any city, there's a lot of traffic, and so things happen. But I love H Street.
So you bought the first property. What happened from there? Because clearly you didn't stop. So what were the next moves? Like what did you get into thereafter?
I think it was 2019. So then I finished the house like March of 2020, refinanced, and then COVID hit. So that's when like rates started dropping. We was at home like, man, what are we gonna do with my time? So I was like, I always wanted to like flip a house. So I found this wholesaler. Her name was Allie. She always sent me deals, but she sent me this smaller deal that I've, you know, and I also would read a lot. I was like, I have enough equity in my home. So then I pulled out I opened a HELOC, which is, you don't pull it out. You know, HELOC is a home equity line of credit. And it allows you to use the equity in your home, essentially like a credit card. So with layman's terms, let's say I bought the house for $300,000. And after I finished renovating it, it was worth $450,000. So $450,000 minus $300,000 is about $150,000. So I had about $150,000 worth of equity that I could utilize and pull from, like a credit card. You know, so did a HELOC, found the wholesaler. She's like, I got this deal in Petworth. Very minimal work. Needs cosmetics, which is key because I don't really have to do a lot of knocking down stuff. So I actually ended up using my HELOC to renovate the home. So that's kind of how I started my first flip. I got the money. Where did I get the money? I purchased it. I'll be layman's terms right now because I'm going to be very authentic. So I bought it was a one-bedroom condo in Petworth, basement unit. Remember that. Also, everything I do is a lesson. It's a great lesson. So I bought it for $160,000, and the ARV, which is the after repair value, was $225,000 conservatively, because when you do valuations for condo buildings, you typically stay within the building. Those are your comps. So I knew I could sell it for $225,000. So I was like, $225,000 minus $160,000, was gonna put like $20,000 in cosmetics. I was like, that's not a bad deal minus like a big enough money. So ended up doing that. So that was my first like small deal. Didn't work out that easily though, because it was a condo building. And if you know anything about condos, they have a lot more stipulation with the bank. They were actually above their ratio for renters in the building. So I think it was like 10 units and over like 50% were rented. So the bank typically doesn't allow you to purchase another unit without putting 20% down. And if you think about an end buyer, if you're buying a one-bedroom condo at $225,000, you probably don't have 20% or $40,000 to put down. So long story short, ended up not getting it under contract. Just found out we can't sell it for what we want. So it sat, and then I was like, it sat because the buyer was going to have to put down 20% or they're going to have to come pay cash. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a big ask for a basement unit. So it sat, Airbnb'd it for a while, ended up selling it like in, I don't know, 6 months later. So we made money on the Airbnb, sold it 6 months later for $185,000. So we just about broke even on it. But again, made my money back, learned my lessons about condos, learned my lessons about, you know, renovating cosmetically without, you know, one GC. This is where I use tradesmen. I learned a lot. So I'm glad I did it, but it got me comfortable getting my feet wet. That was a long response, but I always like to tell that story because people think, oh, I'm about to flip my first house and it's going to be great. And it can be. It can be great. But I think a lot of people sell the dream of real estate investing like it's always going to be perfect. And I think the reality of it is it can be perfect, but you just have to do a little bit more due diligence and legwork. And sometimes breaking even to me is one of the best things that happen. It's better than losing $40,000-$50,000. And I think the lesson to me is worth that. But that was my first flip deal. Long story long. So, yeah.
Appreciate that. And one of the things that I believe people are learning up to this point, and we just on the tip of the iceberg, is that lessons, right? And starting small. The first property was a single family home. The first flip was a condo, right? And there's lessons learned from each of them. A lot of times people look at what is supposed to be lessons as a sign to give up, which is not always that. And think about it. At that moment, right, you could have said, you know what, let me just stick to what I'm doing, maybe this real estate stuff is not for me because I can't seem to get it right when I'm trying something else out. But obviously, you kept going.
I see your point. I'm like, I could have. I think if I wasn't so like, maybe you can relate being like an entrepreneur. You got to have like that, I don't know if you call it crazy or like just like a little naive. If I didn't have that in me, I probably would have just played it safe. And I would have been okay, but like I can't teach these lessons and share these stories with other people. And it didn't, I mean, it wasn't bad. Like nothing bad really happened. Like I didn't lose a lot of money, but I learned a lot. So I'm glad I kept going. And also interest rates were like almost like 2.9, 3%. Like what are we not going to buy a house? Like, so also that was a factor because nowadays I'm like, I don't know, you know,
but yeah, it's different ball game now. Can you explain what a wholesaler does and just the value that they add to or should add to real estate investors?
Yeah, wholesalers essentially find the deals, do the legwork, find the tax sale deals, find the divorcees, the older families that don't want to own their homes anymore. They just want to alleviate their problems. They find these houses, they put them under contract. They say they're going to buy them for really low, and then they'll go find and developers and buyers like myself, maybe you who are or you still want to buy the home. Well, let's say I'm a wholesaler. I bought a property for $100,000, but I know it's worth $300,000. I know, all right, that's $200,000 in equity. I can go wholesale this for $150,000 to a developer and they're going to still want to buy it. So that is a wholesaler's job. They're just a middleman between, you know, initial seller and the end consumer. And sometimes wholesalers, it's a quick deal. Your transaction could take 10 days, it could take 30 days, but they'll make, you know, anywhere between like $5,000 to sometimes $60,000, $70,000 on a wholesale deal. But they're doing the work to find these deals day in and day out and cold calling and knocking on doors. So that's a wholesaler. Is that
clear? That makes a lot of sense. One of the things that I've seen in the last maybe year or so is some states are now requiring wholesalers to have a real estate license, which wasn't a requirement before. What are your thoughts on that? And are they doing that in this area?
I don't know if we've done that here yet.
Okay.
But I've heard that. And I've also heard they're making wholesalers put a cap on how much they can make in terms on the wholesale deal. I have heard that in some states. Because, I mean, the wholesalers are not doing any, I mean, they're really just passing along a deal and they can make a lot of money from it. But yeah, some states make them get their license and now they've put a cap on it. But nowadays I don't want to nip anyone's game, but I find that a lot of wholesale deals don't have enough equity for where we are with material, inflation, interest rates. And so 90% of the time, it's not a deal. The best deals are not going to be talked about. They're going to be like past the people you know, or they're just going to be negotiated really well. So that's one thing I would say too. Watch out for wholesalers. They're not bad. They're not good, but you just have to really know your out value, like your ARV, and also know your closing costs, because sometimes you end up paying closing costs twice. Like you end up paying the buyer's closing costs or the seller's and yours. So you just want to be really clear, read your contracts 3-4 times, have an attorney look at them, because there can be a lot of extra costs with wholesale deals that you might not be privy to in a regular transaction. That's all I would say about that. But I think they're great, but be careful.
Appreciate that. How would someone calculate the ARV, after repair value? So if I'm looking to buy a house, let's just say in this neighborhood, mm-hmm. that is in some distress, what would I do? How would I figure out, all right, what is it going to be worth when it's fixed up?
Look at very similar properties. I always say find a realtor in your neighborhood who is familiar with the area. But if you're looking at a house, 3-bedroom, 2.5-bath, you need to look at comparables that are 3-bedroom, 2.5-bath. I mean, very similar to what the house you're buying for as. And also your distance. Some people do a mile radius around the subject property. I'm very conservative and I'll do block, 2 blocks, maybe 3 blocks over, because I like to get as close to that comparable as possible. And also I'm very conservative. Like if a house sold for $250 a block away 6 months ago, in today's market, I might not think it might be 250 right now. So I might just say, well, let's do an out value of 240, 235. You know, it's like you under promise, over deliver. So I'm very conservative with that, because when you're very conservative, you know where to buy the property at. So you're not making mistakes in the long run. You know how you really want to get as low as you can when you're buying these flips or these renovated properties, because you're going to run into extra costs. You're going to run into problems. So, and you realize the value of a property when you buy it, not when you sell it. I learned that from Rich Dad, Poor Dad, but buying it super low is very important.
Appreciate that.
Yeah. Because once you sell it, I mean, it's a gain. That's a realized gain, but you realize the value when you buy it. That's probably another topic.
It's like they say, you make money on the buy.
Exactly.
Make money on the buy.
Yes.
2019, you said you started, you did your first flip. Mm-hmm. Was that, or when did you start buying rentals again? Because obviously you scaled that up as well.
I did my first rental after the third flip. So after the condo, I did a single family. Finally, I did the flip right. I was like, praise be. So then I put those profits into a fourplex in Petworth. It's like Northwest DC. And that was my first four unit that I burred, which is the, I don't know, you talk about this, the mm-hmm. buy, renovate, rent, refinance, repeat. Mm-hmm. So I did that, gutted it out. I had like watched this property for like 8-9 months because it was in foreclosure. It was listed on the MLS. They wanted a certain amount of money for it. So you could bid on it online. It's not like auction. It was just owned by the bank. So I watched it and watched it. And then by the time I could bid on it, by the deadline, I wasn't even the highest bidder. I was just the highest bidder at the deadline. So that was my first four unit. And I had also met someone who was like, if you want to get into the game of burring properties, you need to learn how to add value. And he was like, the easiest way to add value is to find a vacant home, because you can then turn your four, like three bed or one bedroom units into three bedroom units. And so you add value that way by increasing the rent. One bedroom might rent for $1,000, a three bedroom will rent for $3,000. So going back to me finding a mentor and asking questions and, hey, come get coffee with me. I really want to try this. I knew some friends that have done this. So I watched that deal, ended up speaking with him. He gave me some lenders to reach out to. I learned how to make a pro forma. And again, there's multiple mentors and players that helped me along the way. But a really big purchase, like factor with this, was having a pro forma. Pro forma is huge. I still use it to this day. I mean, when you're thinking about long-term investing, you don't know what your like NOI, which is your net operating costs, are until you know every single expense. Worst case scenario revenue, worst case scenario, you know, monthly expenses. So your pro forma illustrates how much you're making per month and also annually. And then it shows you how much you're paying for electric, you know, water, taxes, insurance, property management fee. All of that is in your pro forma. So you see your bottom line. So I use that pro forma to figure out what I need to offer on the property at. I think I answered your question.
You did.
I'll be rambling.
No, so keep going.
I'm like, what was the question?
No, don't worry. Don't even worry about the question. I keep going.
Yeah. Okay.
This is good.
Yeah. But people had like, you know, Rich Dad Poor Dad talks about burring. I was like, man, this sounds cool. I was like, but one of my friends, he was in commercial real estate, so he did it for a while. He's like, yeah, like look at buying vacant and turning the one bedrooms to three bedrooms. And I leased them with voucher tenants. And I learned that market very quickly with that first four unit. I had no idea what I was getting myself into on the management side. I thought I could manage it myself. That, I'm comedian of the year for that. But no, I couldn't. But I learned a lot about just like the subsidy market in DC. It's a great market, but I think you got to know what you're getting yourself into, but you also have to lead with value. I hate when I see developers put like lipsticks on a pig and like make their properties not livable for a quick sale. And it's like, at the end of the day, people are going to be living in these properties. Like, I take a lot of responsibility in that. Like, everything from foundation all the way to the roof, it's got to be done right, because somebody's child is going to be here. That falls back on me. And so I take a lot of care and concern, especially when I'm working with my team, to make sure these properties are built right. And especially with subsidy housing, DC government is not tenant friendly. They also don't play games. So you have annual inspections every year. So your properties have to be in tip top shape. Doesn't matter if a tenant messed it up or not. You've got to really make sure your properties are maintained or they'll stop paying you. And you've got to have good systems in place with your property managers. You got to have good communication systems with your PMs. You also got to really understand how to find your tenants, work with tenants. And there's got to be a level of compassion when you get into developing properties, but also like subsidy housing. I could talk about that for days, but I think people just see money. And I think it's better when you shift your vision to seeing this is a life, this is a family. This is serious. Let's take it seriously. The money will come, I think, when you focus on the craft and the end consumer and the end tenant. But that's how I got started in 4 units.
I love that. So, a few things. So, how would you define pro forma?
It's essentially, we'll call it like all of your revenue minus all of your expenses. That shows you your net operating income. And then it'll show you your cap rate. Your cap rate is essentially the percentage of your return on investment per year. You get the cap rate by dividing your net operating income, which is your revenue minus all of your expenses, that's your NOI, divided by the money you invested or whatever you purchased a property for. Cap rates, ideally, so like you invest in the S&P 500, I feel like that's not my arena, but I think it's what, 6% return? 5-6 or something?
8 to 10 on average or something like that?
Oh, now it's higher. See, I don't know. But typically with your cap rates, you want them to be, a good cap rate is like double digits. That's ideal. Nowadays, DC is like a 5-6 cap market. The deals I like are 8% and higher. Those are really, because that shows you your return on your investment, like the S&P 500. So I hope that, answers the question. Yeah,
It does. You also mentioned that the home, this 4-unit, was a foreclosure. So is it just as simple as eventually it's going to be up for bid and basically sold to the highest bidder?
Yeah. So typically with foreclosures, especially in DC, not all markets are competitive like DC. So there's opportunity to buy foreclosures and not be competing. I've been to auctions where like one person was only one bidding on it. So it's definitely a possibility in foreclosures. This one just happened to be an online bid, which makes it a little less tense, but it's like refreshing your page all the time to see what the next bid is. But it was on the market for, I think, like 5 months, and I just watched it. I reached out to the listing agent with love letters. They're not love letters. They're just like, I really want this house. And they can care or not care. But I feel like I manifested that because I thought about it a lot. Anyway.
Made it happen. What are some misconceptions that people have about Section 8 from your perspective?
Misconceptions. I think the biggest misconception is that it's too hard to handle. It's not worth the money. It's a headache. And that could be a true concept, but it also can be a misconcept if you're not doing the right measures on the forefront. I think with Section 8, you have to be aware of what type of tenants you're picking. And you also want to be aware of fair housing laws. I worked with a woman who found all my tenants, and she would advise me to, just be cautious of it. There's a lot of families with domestic violence, so with like abusive partners that you want to watch out for, because that ends up being issues for every other unit in the building. Things like that you want to look out for. you know, just there's a lot of things that I can't always say in public, but it is, I was advised on this by someone who worked with Section 8 for like 20 years. And she told me things to look out for, like emergency tenants. I think something that I can say though is you ask for your referrals, but I've also had landlords who have just told me their tenant was amazing and I took them and they ended up being the worst tenant in the world. So some people just pass them up so they can get rid of them. And it's just, sometimes it's kind of tough, but I think a lot of the times I'm meeting tenants face to face, I'm kind of gauging their energy, their level of respect, the level of cleanliness, and kind of taking it from there, because you do have to abide by fair housing laws too. But you do your background check, your credit check, your income. My income I don't really do income because it's subsidized, but I always talk to the landlords prior, their current landlord. You know, how were they? Were they clean? Can we get the maintenance done? Stuff like that. But yeah.
I understand. So you did also say that for a period of time you did self-manage that building once everything was, you know, up and running. What were some of the you said you were comedian of the year. So what were some of those challenges? What were some of those challenges that you had self-managing for that period of time?
What? I mean, I don't know who I thought I was. This is what I mean, where I'm like a little bit like, I can do anything. It's just market rate tenants are very different from subsidized housing tenants. Just different people, there's different issues they have. So I look very young. I'm 32. I think I was 28 at the time. I look 15. So they don't even know that I own the building. So one thing I also thought was okay to give my, I think I texted all four tenants in like a group chat. And the lady was like, what are you doing? Like, don't do that. And like, now that I'm like years in the game, no tenant has my number. Like, I don't want to be bothered by anyone because we have systems in place. But I thought like, it'll be easy because I've managed market rate tenants and their attorneys, and like, yeah, they communicate very fine. It's very simple to get a maintenance order. But I think I had gotten like cursed out at 8 in the morning, and I was like, yeah, I'm going to throw my towel in. I was like, this is not for me. But yeah. It's, I think every person in real estate investing has a story, like a wild story, yeah. You know, like it's just, what are you going to do? You know, like it's part of the game.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate your transparency because it's for some people and it's not for other people. Like, some people like self-managing and some don't, you know. I self-manage. There's ups and downs to it. Sometimes, like right now, I wish I had a property manager, right? But, you know, there's a upside and a downside to either choice that you make. However, you keep going. You keep going. You don't just throw your hands up and sell the property. You figure out, how can I solve this problem? And you solve the problem by getting someone to help you manage it, and you move on.
And it's like, I think everything is, it's possible. Like, it's possible that it can be fixed. Like, this is, you know, it's just tenant communications. I think you have to set the level of expectation with your tenants. Mm-hmm. You don't do that by over communicating. I think you do that by sometimes setting the tone and sometimes not responding when things get a little, like, you just reach out to him. This is the order of operations. And yeah, it's like a level of authority you might constantly fight if you're always you can't talk to your tenants 24/7, but a lot of the times they want you to, you just can't. And so you have to set that level of expectations with them and put systems in place. So, but it's, I think every problem is solvable. It's solvable. And sometimes it could be like, this might not be the best deal, but there's always a solution for everything. And if you put on your thinking cap, converse with the right people, ask a mentor, like, it's not the end of the world. Mm-hmm. You're going to figure it out. And I think if you have that mindset with investing, even in life, I think it'll be okay.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. So for that four unit, how did you fund that deal in the rehab?
I did a 90-10 purchase and rehab loan. So 90-10 means the bank gives you 90% of the money, and then I put 10% down. Kind of like the FHA I was telling about, like if you purchase it for $100,000 and $50,000 a rehab, you're bringing 3.5% of the $150,000. That's what I did. I bought 10% of the purchase price and the acquisition price in the cost. Yeah, so that was a deal, but it was hard money. So with hard money, it's different than your FHA and your conventional loans because you're not backed by Fannie or Freddie, which are backed by the Federal Reserve. Hard money gets their money from like private equity partners or private lender, private donors like myself or you who just, I want to invest in like a lending firm or something like that. So it's a little easier to get a loan, and they look less at you as a buyer, but they look more at the deal. Like, okay, if she buys it for this and the after repair value is here and she's putting this much of rehab work in it, this makes sense because I know it'll sell for X amount of dollars. They're looking at the deal itself. They're looking at your experience too, which is when partners come in helpful to go in with you on a deal. But it's a little less scrutinized than Fannie Freddie. But the caveat is that your interest rate is higher and your closing costs are higher. And you might have like a 6-month term or 12-month term. 6-month term meaning you got to pay all the money back in 6 months, or 12-month terms means you have to pay all the money back in 12 months. So just shorter timelines, a little more riskier, but it can be easier to get the money to do the job.
Would you suggest someone just starting out use a hard money lender?
No.
Why is that?
It's risky. I would suggest it if you have a partner that's done it before. The thing with hard money is, like, if you go through those lists of closing documents, it's a lot of, like, it could be, like, if you default on this loan, like, your house is taken for collateral. So it's a lot riskier. So if it's your first home, I would not recommend a hard money loan. I would recommend a 203 FHA or a conventional loan, something that's backed by Fannie or Freddie. Second deal, yeah, try it out. Maybe it might not be your thing. Again, hard money has higher interest rates. Hard money is a higher risk. So those are just things to think about. And like we were saying before, is start small, do the easy, or find people to go in with you on a deal. If that makes sense. Yeah.
I really appreciate you mentioning that, because if you look online, they'll make it seem like nothing can ever go wrong with the hard money lender. Everybody should do it out the gate, and that's just how you do it. And, you know, that's how you buy 45 properties in 1 year. Like, people really need to get back to the basics and understand, yeah, you build it brick by brick. You don't have to be like a rocket and, you know what I'm saying, like, get this huge portfolio in 18 months. You know, like, you don't have to do all that. It's cool to be inspired, but what I find is that a lot of people feel like they have to go at everyone else's speed, but that's not the case.
You shouldn't. Real estate is a long-term game, mm-hmm, as you know. And I guess I can tell on one of my clients, because
let's tell
y'all on. Don't know him. Y'all don't know him. But and this was also advised by a lender. So they're one of my listings now. So he's got a 4-unit. He's had it for like 7 years. He purchased the 4-unit with an FHA loan, which is put 3.5% down with the intent to move there. I think he and his wife live nearby. The story made sense. I think last minute they ended up not moving in, ended up like renting out all 4 units with voucher tenants. But he still put 3.5% down on a high value loan in the middle of Columbia Heights. So can you do that now legally? No. Like, as a lender, I'd say, no, that's not legal. But his lender was a one to tell him to do that. I'm not saying people do this, but people do this. And some people do FHA and 3.5% down and live there for 6 months to a year. That's a great way to build your portfolio and house hack. Buy a duplex, buy a 2-unit, a 4-unit, 3.5% down or 5% down, live there a year if it's FHA, move out. Like, there is a way to gradually build your portfolio over time without throwing wads of cash at these investments. And it's also really important to understand that your cash is king, and it's important to use other people's money as much as you can when you're flipping and burying these properties. But my point is that it's attainable. You don't have to build it quickly. I wouldn't advise building your portfolio so quickly. It's like giving someone $10 million that's only had like $1,000 for their name. That handling that amount of responsibility and money, is you don't learn that overnight. And it's very dangerous to do that. So I think taking your time with it will be helpful in the long run, especially. And it's real estate's not like a get rich quick thing. It's really, it's long term. It's wealth building for your generations to come.
I agree with that. Would you say that client got bad advice or dangerous advice?
I think no. Now he's like a commercial developer in DC. He actually wants to get rid of this now. The problem is that it's an assumable loan. FHA has like assumable loans. And so it's under contract now, but they're like, I'm not going to live there. I don't want to go to jail. What if they catch me?
So, can you, if they catch you, what's okay. Yeah. So if you do FHA and you basically don't live there, like you agreed mm-hmm. to or whatever the case is, what can happen if they find out, if they do some audit and, you know, start knocking on doors or something like that, or checking mail, like
inspections.
Yeah.
You could go to jail. I think you got to read what's in your lending packet, like your closing mm-hmm. packet. This packet specifically said you have to have the intent to move in at settlement. Again, lawyers will tell you all day, understand the jargon. The intent to move in is different than moving in. However, an inspector could say, I don't know, this is FHA, you're stealing our money. So I'm not recommending anyone do this. Like, don't be like, Taylor told me, go do house hack with FHA. No, but I'm saying you don't have to throw so much money at your investments. There's ways to build your investments over time. But yeah, you could go to jail. I think one buyer for this property was like, I consulted an attorney and it's a class A felon. And I was like, oh God, Jesus, okay. All right, we're going to remove the contract. We're not doing this. But this buyer under contract is going to live there. So yeah.
All right, so everybody be safe. It sounds like it's working out.
Be safe for sure. I did not tell anyone to do that. I'm just saying. It's possible. People have done it.
People be doing it. That's all you said.
Yeah.
What is an assumable mortgage?
It's when you can, if you have a house mm-hmm. and you bought it in 2020, mm-hmm. your interest rate is probably like 3%. And if it's FHA, I can assume that interest rate as long as I pay whatever your house appreciated. So let's say you bought your house for $100,000 at a 3% interest rate. Now it's 2024. It's probably worth, let's say, like, I don't know, 150, right? So it went up in equity 50 grand. I can still assume your loan for 3% on $100,000. I don't know, what is it, like $500 a month? But I've got to find a way to come up with the delta, that extra 50K. But I still got a 3% interest rate. So as long as you can come up with the difference of the loan amount and the current value, assumability is wonderful. I don't know when we're going to see 3% loans again. I hope I'm alive to see it, but... That's kind of the play of assumability or assumable loans.
Do you know if FHA is the only way to get an assumable loan, potentially?
That's a good question. I'm not a lender, so I won't speak specifically to it, but okay. I do know that the loans that are assumable that I've seen have been FHA.
Okay.
Conventional, not so much.
Yeah.
Not so much, yeah.
Got you. That's interesting. That's a good thing for people to keep in mind. So for the next couple of rentals, did you follow the same process and just kind of like utilizing the Burr method, buying something, putting appreciation, refinancing out and all that? Is that kind of the path you followed to buy the next several?
Yeah. Because you know with the Burr, like whatever you put in, mm-hmm. like if you put like 10 grand in the deal, when it's all said and done, you're taking that 10 grand out and you're moving it to the next property. Mm-hmm. So after the 4-unit, I think I bought a duplex with the same way. And then, I flipped the duplex. And then I took those profits and put it in another 4-unit. And then from that 4-unit, put it in another duplex. So it's just rinse, repeat.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, Burr. Yeah.
Burr.
Just repeating. I mean, that's the thing. You got $100 invested. Yeah. All right, this deal's done. I'll move that 100 to the next one, to the next one. It's just...
Yeah.
I'd like to call it, it's economical.
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense. So it sounds like it was some mixture of like, you know, flipping, getting some capital, buying a property, doing the Burr, and just moving that same money around to duplicate the process to the greatest extent possible.
More or less. You make it sound very simple, because it can be, but I remember I got a home equity line of credit.
Yes.
I rinsed and repeat that so much. Poor thing. I use that all the time. I use it all the time. And that's where I got a lot of that down payment capital from, is from my that first house on H Street. But yeah, it's like, it's that's the process. But it's with your BRRRR, you can't refinance and recoup all of your investment unless you're adding value. And you can add value through square footage. You can add value through one bedrooms, making them three bedrooms to raise the rents. You can add value by making the house nicer, cosmetically friendly, you know, update the kitchen. So there's a lot of ways to add value. So that's a major piece of buying a property that is imperative to know. Yeah. Adding value. Yeah.
Did you become a realtor before you started investing?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I didn't wake up knowing how to do this. But I remember reading Rich Dad Poor Dad, and he was like, if you really want to get doing anything, Dr. Laura, you have to educate yourself. And so I read Rich Dad Poor Dad, but then I was like, I want to get around people that do this all the time. Like, I want to see what they do day to day. And so I learned a lot. I joined a top team. I didn't make a lot of money, but I learned a lot. And by educating myself, I became a lot more comfortable buying that first house, you know, and then renovating it. So
have you represented yourself on all your deals?
Oh, I always do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cause you get the
so you're making money multiple ways then.
Or you just credit it towards your closing costs.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a really good point.
At the table. It helps. I guess, you know, it helps.
Of course it helps.
Yeah.
Of course it helps. It's very advantageous because you're using it. Yeah. Right. You know, using it obviously to represent your clients and all the people you're helping, and then yourself. And, you know, you can see deals like it. There's not a downside, if especially if you're using it. Right.
You're using it
in some way.
Yeah. And you're using it to help your clients. Like, I've had my last client, well, a year ago, she did a 1031 exchange. She's been renovating it for a year. I could talk so cleanly to like renovating the house and what to expect because I had done it a lot of times. And that's the thing I like. Like, I feel like, yeah, renovating for myself is great, but like helping people is way more valuable to me because then she learns as well. She teaches someone else. Mm-hmm. Like the houses I flipped, they've all gone to black women. We became friends. They now want to invest in their next flip. So it's just a pay it forward method too of like teaching, like you're doing with your interns. I feel like we owe that to, you know,
yeah.
We owe that, you know.
It's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And so what has been some challenges you've experienced as a black woman who is in this space? So you're an investor, you're a realtor. What are some challenges you face?
People not taking me seriously. Because I just look young and I'm small and petite. So working with men was tough in the beginning until I cut them a check. Then they were like, okay, she's not going to walk away. She's serious. So that was always tough. And then you kind of have your like buyers or sellers that try to flirt with you. But I think you know how to like dodge that. But just taking you seriously, I think it's, you kind of have to, I don't know, walk a certain way, or you know how the language to use when you're in front of your clients and when you're in front of lenders and contractors. So that's probably the toughest. But you got to ignore that. Like, that's going to be a roadblock if you pay attention to it.
Yeah. Do you find that it's hard for you to ignore that? Or is that something you have to grow into to be able to just ignore like the nonsense and just focus on getting the job done and what you need to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's not really.
Yeah.
I was raised by my father, so I kind of could see through a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And I think you just have to carry yourself in a certain way.
Yeah.
I did have two contractors that, like, started fighting on site. And I was like, there's nothing I can do in this situation. So I'm just let them fight it out. You
just had to wait till they settled it.
I was like, this is great. It was my electrician and my plumber. I was like, oh, guys, what are you going to do? But if it was a man, they would not, you know, they might respect the time more.
Well, I think you did the right thing. So
I'm not getting involved.
Yeah,
with
it's
that.
Not even worth it. I mean, if they're hashing it out, I'll be outside. Let me know when y'all done.
Right. They're not even about to hear me. Like,
yeah.
But yeah, that was funny. Kenny and Fred.
Those names sound like they go together.
They do.
Yeah, complimentary.
Yeah. Kenny and Fred.
Do you still work with them?
I do. I still refer them. I just referred Fred 2 days ago to one of my friends.
Have they worked together since then?
Probably not. Yeah, they don't. Kenny and Mario work together a lot, but mm-hmm. Fred, not so much.
Yeah. So what's the lay of the land right now in D.C., DMV area? Obviously, all over the country, in many places, like, prices have shot up the last couple of years. Obviously, interest rates as well. What are you seeing right now in the market?
I mean, here in D.C., it's very competitive. I think everywhere else is competitive, too. These interest, but in the right locations is competitive, excuse me. But then you've got places, even outskirts of D.C., where some prices are just sitting because people are not willing to pay top dollar because of how high interest rates are. So that goes back to, like, location is super important when you really want to get top dollar. But interest rates, again, it drives demand where it can. If you've got a great house and a great prop, like a great location, it'll sell. But I think it's important for sellers to also be realistic about what they're asking for in times like this, because, you know, 3% interest rate to 6-7% interest rate, that's like double your mortgage, you know. And it really is, it changes the dynamic of what you're paying monthly, and that changes what a buyer, if they're like gonna decide to buy or not. So it's important to just be realistic on what you're asking for, because demand everywhere else is not what it was in 2020, but it still is competitive in the right locations. It's not like clear cut answer.
Yeah.
But interest rates dictate a lot, as we've seen.
I agree with you. Do you think some sellers are being delusional with their pricing and where they keep them at over time?
I wouldn't say they're delusional. I say they're passionate about their investment. We'll say that right now.
I like that. I'll take it.
Yeah. As an agent, it's your job to educate your clients. Mm-hmm. Now, at the end of the day, we have to do what they say, right? If they want to list it at $1 million and it's worth $800,000, fine, it'll sit. And then you'll be upset. But it's our job to educate them. It's our job to show them why it's worth X amount of money. And it's our job to advocate for them if someone does come in and want to buy it. So it's just a battle. Like, people are emotionally tied to their properties. I get it. Not everybody is a qualitative investor or a quantitative investor. People are quality driven. So yeah, some are a little passionate about the value of their homes. And others are like, listen, I want to get rid of it. I want to put it into something else. So
yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you've accomplished a lot since you've gotten started, and through all the ups and downs, like, you're still here, you know, you're still investing, you're still selling and representing buyers and things, and you're continuing to go. And I mean, obviously you're doing a whole lot other, we need a whole another hour to, to talk about, you know, business and everything else you're doing. So maybe we gotta do a part two, but how do you feel just accomplishing what you have and, you know, overcoming some of those early challenges? Because I'm thinking about, you know, that first property you bought, challenges with that first contract, the challenges with the first flip and the condo. Mm-hmm. How does it feel to look back and see, like, what you've been able to do?
I'm grateful. I'm very grateful. I'm happy I did it. I'm happy I took the chance. But again, it's not about me. Like, I would love to inspire someone to do the same thing and learning from the lessons that I've learned. So I'm glad I did it. Like, I think about it. I'm spiritual, so like I pray over my properties. I pray over the families in them because I just care a lot. So to me, it's personal, but it's also, it's a business, but it is like, I take a lot of pride in it because I knew what I had to go through to deal with a lot of what I dealt with outside of developing and tenants. But my goal is someone to learn from it, which is why I like doing podcasts like that. I think I reached out to you in January. Like, my goal is to just pay it forward and teach someone the best way that I'm able to.
We did that today. So, yeah.
You do that all the time. Yeah.
Appreciate that. Yeah. So as we wrap up, what are a couple tips you have for someone who is looking to get into, whether it's investing, flipping, and they happen to live in a place like DC where it's just an expensive market and they're feeling discouraged? What are a few tips you would give that can help them, give them the best likelihood of succeeding in spite of the market conditions?
One, I'd find a mentor or just someone, grab them out for coffee, take them for coffee, ask them questions. Two, I'd educate yourself outside of getting a mentor on the market, on what you want to do, And just understanding transactions, construction, financing. And three, I think I'd pick like one to two people who are at a place where you want to be at and kind of mimic what they did. I see a lot of like people say that, like if you can kind of mimic their path, or maybe it's like their day to day or their habits, or they are very structured in their schedule, like things like that. I would say find someone, mimic them, reach out to them. Those are the three things I remember. Like I couldn't have bought properties without a mentor. I couldn't have believed in myself if someone didn't believe in me. So those are probably the three things that I would recommend.
Love that. And for someone who is currently a realtor or an aspiring realtor, and as you know, there have some realtors have moved on to other things just because of the challenges of the last couple of the market and everything. Mm-hmm. Someone who's just breaking in or trying to be successful, what are a couple of tips you would give them to deal with this current market?
Educate yourself, one. Two, give yourself like at least 3 months. I think when they say when you start out, give yourself at least 3 months to break into your first deal. And it's so cliche to say don't give up, but don't give up and like give yourself grace. Like people have been doing this for 10, 20, 30 years. If you're just starting out, take it with a grain of salt. Be focused, be diligent, and have a plan of like where you want to be in 6 months, 9 months, a year, and try to stay steadfast along that plan and have the mindset of like it's possible. These problems are solvable, and it's all within your mindset too.
I agree.
That'll be my advice.
I agree. I appreciate that. So what are your future plans like in real estate? Like what are you looking to do, you know, investing wise and as a realtor and all that stuff? What comes to mind?
I was telling someone earlier, I would love to buy larger units, but more so in a less saturated markets like mm-hmm. the Midwest. When I have time, I've always wanted to get up to 50 units. Mm-hmm. Sounds nice. That's been my goal, but my work has transitioned to government contracting. But that's still a goal of mine. That's still a goal of mine.
Yeah, it's possible. It's definitely possible.
It's possible, right?
Yeah, it is. Absolutely, yeah. It's possible. Mm-hmm. So where would be the best place for people to reach out to you if they want to talk some more, or maybe if they want you to represent them, or just to keep in touch and see mm-hmm. you know how you continue to develop and grow?
Probably my Instagram. Instagram is my name, Taylor, TAELOR.Salmon, SALMON. So it's the same on Instagram and TikTok. I've been posting a little on TikTok, but those two places.
Perfect. Really appreciate you getting on the show tonight. It great game, you know, a lot of knowledge, and I appreciate that we like broke things down for people and helped them understand the process and that it's possible. I think that's the theme. It's possible, you know.
It's possible.
In spite of whatever the challenges that are going to come, people can do this. You know, we can do this. So I appreciate your transparency as well.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Happy to help. Happy to help. So hopefully it's been helpful, but I like doing stuff like this. This is great.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for coming to DC.
Oh yeah, yeah. I love it here. I hoping I can come back soon.
Yeah, you gotta stay longer.
I know. I need like 2 weeks.
Plethora of restaurants you gotta go to.
I got a lot more work to do here, so that just means I gotta come back sooner.
True.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, thank you everyone for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue. If you haven't already, you're on YouTube, make sure you like this video, subscribe to the channel. If you're on the audio side, make sure you leave a 5-star rating and review. We would greatly appreciate it. Thank you all so much, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue. And be sure to leave us 5 stars and a review on your favorite podcast listening platform. Until next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.